brought to you by RadioWerewolf.com.
Race relations in America are at their lowest point in decades, according to a new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll. The survey conducted earlier in the month found only 34% of Americans think the racial climate in the country is either fairly good or very good. The poll peaked when 77% of respondents said racial relations were good in January of 2009, just after Barack Obama became the nation's first black president. But those numbers have been dropping precipitously since 2012, after unarmed black teen Trayvon Martin was killed by George Zimmerman after he pursued Martin because he thought the teen looked suspicious. The record pessimism this year was mostly attributed to high-profile police brutality cases across the country. Incidents in Chicago, Baltimore, Ferguson, Missouri, and several other cities all drew massive protests from activists who claimed the deaths, all of black males, were racially motivated. While each race surveyed concurred the racial climate in America is in rough shape, black respondents were much more likely to view race relations unfavorably. The annual survey, which has been conducted for more than 20 years, hasn't seen race relations viewed this poorly since October 1995, when O.J. Simpson was acquitted of murder in a racially divisive trial. Unsurprisingly, politics played a part in the survey as well. The same poll found 22% of Democrats said use of force by the police was the most important news story of 2015, compared to just 7% of Republicans. Fred Yang, who conducted the poll for the Wall Street Journal, said, "If you're a Republican, you're more oriented toward foreign policy or international issues. Given who Democrats are, demographically and attitudinally, that's just something they're going to be concerned about." For Newsy, I'm Grant Sunison.
A few weeks ago on this program, we reported the following.
Well, the German press is describing it as a table microphone. And what the table microphone picked up was Merkel sort of muffledly asking a question to Zuckerberg. And then you hear Zuckerberg, and it's on this issue of what Facebook is going to do about monitoring, policing, racist, xenophobic comments about refugees here in Germany. It's a big issue. We hear for Zuckerberg's response pretty clearly on the tape, or at least people who are listening, it did. He said, "We need to do some work." And then, guy, there's the Merkel follow-up. She basically asked the same question again and says, "But you're working on this." And Zuckerberg can only say yes.
Well, yes, indeed he was. The announcement came 2 days ago from Reuters. The headline, "Facebook, Google, and Twitter agreed to delete hate speech in 24 hours in Germany." Germany said on Tuesday that Facebook, Google, and Twitter have agreed to delete hate speech from their websites within 24 hours, a new step in the fight against rising online racism following the refugee crisis. The government has been trying to get social platforms to crack down on the rise of anti-foreigner comments in German on the web as the country struggles to cope with an influx of more than 1 million refugees this year.
So people can't express their opinion about this then?
Correct.
So
the new agreement makes it easier for users and anti-racism groups to report hate speech to specialist teams at the three companies, according to German Justice Minister Heiko Maas. "When the limits of free speech are trespassed, when it is about criminal expressions, sedition, incitement to carry out criminal offenses that threaten people, such content has to be deleted from the net," Maas said. "And we agree that as a rule, this should be possible within 24 hours.
So, hey, you know, this Syrian jerk off is pooping on my stoop.
Hate speech. Hate speech. Stop. And what's disturbing is that the Washington Post even has to go so far, I don't know what they're being taught in schools, but they actually have to write a whole article to explain that there is no hate speech exception in the First Amendment. And, you know, we have gotten so far down this road. Yeah. They felt compelled to have to explain it. And it's a pretty long article, and they go into exactly, you know, so we do have one exception, which is fighting words, which is, you know, if you incite someone to lash out and fight immediately because of your direct speech, there is an exception for that. But it's also, you know, the nuance is very small. But in general, speech is speech, all form of speech. But people somehow believe that hate speech is illegal. And now you see the Washington Post trying to say, hey, you know, it's really not that way, which is just baffling to me. And then you see this, Germany, like, oh, hate speech, we're going to take it off the, well, not off the internet, but taking it off the social media, which for most people is the internet.
This is true.
Yeah. And, it's disturbing, but,
Yeah, I found the story disturbing, too, but luckily we know it can't happen here.
Hello, my name is Aaron Weiss, and I live in the town of Poughkeepsie. I'm a combat veteran of Iraq, and I'm also a law enforcement officer. I attended the Public Safety Committee's last meeting in regards to this resolution, but I didn't say anything because I wanted to hear what everyone else had to say. And I heard some shocking things from some people and some legislators. They said that it took a lot of courage to pass this SAFE Act. Apparently, my definition of courage differs from yours. You see, if it was really so courageous a bill and it took so much courage to pass it, then why was it done in the middle of the night when no one could see it or read it? That's not courage. That's a mafia-style sit-down to divvy up what's good for the bosses. Courage is taking the right and true course of action, not the politically expedient one. And anyone who is proud of this law must also be proud of the Patriot Act, the TSA, imprisoning Japanese citizens in World War II, since all these actions were spurred on by emotional fear and rammed through in the name of public safety. Another issue is the insistence of certain people to stand on the graves of dead children and challenge those that disagree to say it to the parents' faces. Well, I, for one, will pick up that gauntlet. First off, why is dead children your battle cry? You didn't say anything about the hundreds of Chicago children being killed, and for some reason you only scream when it happens to wealthy white ones. And yes, I will say to anyone's face, my right is more important than your dead, because I fought for it firsthand. I washed the blood of my friends out of my Humvee, and I picked up their mangled bodies, and I fought day in and day out. I did more things that you people can't imagine. So yeah, my right trumps your dead. I earned it in blood. I gave up a lot for this country, including my youth, and better men than me gave up a whole lot more, so that all you, myself included, could enjoy the rights that are guaranteed to us in our Constitution and Bill of Rights. And we didn't go through all that to come back home and watch the surrender of what we fought for happen based on the demented actions of a couple madmen. So in closing, I would like to address specifically the legislators we all know who are going to vote against this resolution. I understand you will vote against this resolution based on some misguided sense of the public good. However, as a law enforcement officer, I'm curious to know about your true resolve. Since voting to take away someone's rights is totally different than being asked to enforce it, I want you to consider this. If you support the SAFE Act so wholeheartedly, are you willing to stand with law enforcement members and lead from the front to enforcement? And what I mean by that is, if a constituent of yours feels so alienated by this law and the manner in which it was passed that they refuse to comply with it, are you willing to stack up on their front door and go in first? I bet if a clause was in this bill that required you, the elected leadership, our elected leaders, to go in the door first, I bet you would not be so steadfast.
Virginia teacher's geography assignment has prompted officials to close every school in one of the state's counties on Friday. The assignment was to copy the Shahada, or the main Islamic creed, in Arabic calligraphy. Arabic calligraphy is a historical expression of art and oftentimes uses text from the Quran. But some parents were upset, even though the assignment was voluntary, according to local media. After being inundated with calls and emails, the county school system made the decision Thursday evening. Parents held a meeting against the calligraphy assignment and said their kids could be indoctrinated to Islamic beliefs. But local media report the assignment did not give a definition of the Shahada. One parent spoke out on Facebook saying, I am preparing to confront the county on this issue of the Muslim indoctrination taking place here in an Augusta County school. This evil has been cloaked in the form of multiculturalism. While public schools can't teach religion, the school says the assignment wasn't designed to promote a religious viewpoint or change any students' religious beliefs. The school is expected to reopen after the weekend. For Newsy, I'm Melissa Prax.
Well, ever since 9/11, Americans have been bombarded with the message that Islam is a religion of peace. But around the world, many terrorists claim their actions are inspired by the teachings of the Quran. So what's the real story? Here's CBN News anchor Lee Webb.
The Islam is Peace campaign began in earnest the day after 9/11, when President Bush visited this mosque in Washington, D.C.
The face of terror is not the true faith of Islam. That's not what Islam is all about. Islam is peace.
And the leading Muslim advocacy group, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, has continued to spread the Islam is peace message through the media, even though CARE is now an unindicted co-conspirator in a terrorism case.
Islam is not about hatred and violence. It's about peace and justice.
Some have even suggested that Christianity is somehow as dangerous or more dangerous than radical Islam. Rosie O'Donnell said as much on the program The View last year.
And if you take radical Islam and you want to talk about what's going on there, you have,
and just
you
one second,
have to.
Radical Christianity is just as threatening as radical Islam in a country like America.
But is it? A new book says there's no comparison. Religion of Peace, Why Christianity Is and Islam Isn't, by Robert Spencer, says that while the Bible teaches Christians to love their enemies, the Quran teaches Muslims to be ruthless with unbelievers. This was the reaction of some British Muslims in London last year after a Danish cartoonist drew Muhammad with a bomb in his turban. It has been said that while most of the world's Muslims are not terrorists, most of the world's terrorists are Muslims. But many on the left still fear Christianity more than Islam. Spencer says it's time for the West to defend Christianity and tell the truth about Islam.
Well, joining us now live from Boston is Robert Spencer. He's the author of Religion and Peace, Why Christianity Is and Islam Isn't. Well, welcome to the 700 Club.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
I've had an interesting conversation with some Arab ambassadors a couple of weeks ago, and one of them actually said that Islam is in need of a reformation. Is that sort of a prevailing view amongst, I guess, moderate Muslims?
It's a common view, but I'll tell you one thing about that, Gordon. It's very important to understand. In Christianity, the Reformation was an attempt to get back to the basics, right? To clear away things that had crept in over the centuries that were not authentic and to restore the purity of the original message of the New Testament. Now, in Islam, there's already been a Reformation like that. Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, the founder of the Wahhabi movement, was an 18th century reformer in Arabia, and that's exactly what he proposed to do. He cleared away everything that was a later addition in Islam and got back to just what the Quran said and what Muhammad taught. And it became the most violent and virulent form of Islam that the world has yet seen. So I'm not really sure that a reformation is what is needed. What might be needed is a rejection of a literal understanding of a lot of passages of the Quran.
Well, give us some examples of how is the Quran more violent than the Bible?
Well, you know, of course, we all know that in the Old Testament, there are passages where God tells Joshua to clear out whole cities and things like that. But the one thing that he never does is say, and all believers should go and do likewise, or that this is your instructions, this is your pattern to follow. There have been many ways that interpreters have understood those passages, most of the time in a spiritualized way, that they in some way stand for the struggle against sin within the soul of every believer. But in the Quran, it's unmistakable that there are passages like in chapter 9, verse 5, slay the unbelievers wherever you find them. Chapter 9, verse 29, which extends and specifies the fight to refer even to Jews and Christians until they submit as inferiors under the rule of Islamic law. These things are not spiritualized, and they are directed as open-ended, universalized commands to all believers to fight against unbelievers. And that's how they've been understood by mainstream Islamic commentators through the centuries. So it's ridiculous when people say, well, the Bible is just as violent as the Quran. It just indicates that they don't really know what either one of them says.
Is it possible for Christianity and Islam to peacefully coexist, or are they mutually exclusive?
Well, in terms of doctrine, they're mutually exclusive because, of course, in 1 John it says, if you do not have the Son, you do not have the Father, whereas in the Quran it says anybody who says that Jesus is the Son of God is an unbeliever. And so... Excuse me, those two things don't coexist. But of course, Christians are prepared to coexist peacefully with anyone. But Islamic traditional doctrine, traditional Islamic law, does not allow for peaceful coexistence between believers and unbelievers as equals in a society on an indefinite basis. Muhammad said Islam must dominate and not be dominated. And ultimately, unfortunately, all too many Muslims consider that to be an imperative to push to impose Islamic law upon the societies where they live. live, and that means second-class status for non-Muslims.
We don't seem to be able to get this. Back in World War II, Winston Churchill called that struggle a struggle for Christendom, and he was very bold in saying that, but we don't seem to get this. We seem to want to distance ourselves, if you will, from the basis of Western civilization. We don't want to claim that all our concepts are based on Christianity. Why are we so reluctant to get into this and say our ideas are better?
Well, you know, it's a strange thing, but it seems as if a kind of self-hatred has gripped Western civilization. We're ashamed of ourselves. We're ashamed of our Judeo-Christian heritage. Even people who aren't Jews and Christians are unwilling to acknowledge that the Judeo-Christian tradition has been responsible for the greatest civilization the world has ever known. This self-hatred, I think, has become part of the pop culture ever since the Vietnam War, and that now it's really coming down to a challenge for us, because the Islamic law that the jihadists want to impose upon the world would deny basic things that we take for granted: freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, the equality of dignity of all people before God, the equality of rights of men with women, the equality of rights of all people regardless of creed, so that there's not a special class of people as there is in Islamic law. These things are all Judeo-Christian principles. And so this is the time when we need to cast that off and stand up and defend those things, or we're certainly going to lose them.
There seems to be a movement, and it's frankly political, that Christians are just as bad as radical Muslims. And I know CNN is doing a whole series this week, and AP just released a rather puff piece on it saying, you know, that everybody needs to watch it. And in that segment, they're going to say that if Christians are encouraging young women to dress modestly, what's the difference between that and the Taliban?
I saw that.
Why are we doing that? Why is that even allowed? Why does Rosie O'Donnell get applause for saying that, you know, Christians are just as bad as radical Muslims?
Well, this is the common assumption among the mainstream media, and it's just that fundamentalism, so-called, is the problem across the board. And so they have to make these ridiculous comparisons between modest dress in a Christian context and the Taliban. Do they even realize what goes on for women in the Taliban, that they kill girls who try to go to school, that in Saudi Arabia, which is a society very similar to the society established by the Taliban, there were girls who died in a fire because the religious police wouldn't let them come out of the school that was burning because they weren't wearing their headscarves. I mean, where have you ever seen Christians behave that way when they talk about modesty? It's a comparison that is so ridiculous as to be laughable, and yet it does seem to be the prevailing view of the elite. And the only thing I know to do is to, well, I say thank God for CBN and for the fact that we're able to speak the truth here, and we know that since what we're saying is true, that reasonable people, I think, will be able to see the difference.
Well, I love to tell people I've never heard of United Methodist Jihad. It just doesn't.
Yes.
It doesn't exist in Christianity. You don't go out and kill people. The final question: do you think that within a Muslim society where Sharia law is sort of enshrined, and one of the great disappointments of both Afghanistan and Iraq is that that's precisely what our State Department allowed, that their new constitutions enshrine Sharia as the law of the land. Is it possible with that to have true democracy?
No, because Sharia law does not allow equality of rights for non-Muslims and for women. And so if you're talking about democracy in the sense that it's always been understood in the West as, first of all, ensuring, enshrining the rights of the individual as being something that is pertaining to his dignity before God, then that's one of the first things denied in Sharia for certain groups of people. And so ultimately those provisions in the Iraqi and Afghanistan constitutions are going to militate against the establishment of any kind of genuine Western-style democracy in either country.
Robert, thank you for being with us, and thank you for this book, Religion of Peace.
Thank you.
Why Christianity Is and Islam Isn't. It's available in bookstores across the country.
of the big back and forth moments between you and Senator Marco Rubio was on immigration. Many people said you scored some points against Marco Rubio there. You also said, though, and it has been checked today at the debate, that you denied that you've ever supported legal status for undocumented immigrants. You said, quote, "I've never supported legalization. I do not intend to support it." But back in 2013, you did support an amendment. And back when you were making the case, this is what you said.
"I don't want immigration reform to fail. I want immigration reform to pass. And so I would urge people of good faith on both sides of the aisle, if the objective is to pass common sense immigration reform that secures the borders, that improves legal immigration, and that allows those who are here illegally to come in out of the shadows, then we should look for areas of bipartisan agreement and compromise to come together."
Now, that amendment would have allowed undocumented immigrants to remain in the U.S. permanently and obtain legal status. So how do you square that circle?
Actually, Brett, it wouldn't have. What was happening there is that was the battle over the Gang of Eight, the Rubio-Schumer amnesty bill, which was a massive amnesty bill proposed by Senator Rubio, by Chuck Schumer, and Barack Obama. And I was leading the fight against amnesty. I was standing shoulder to shoulder with Jeff Sessions. I was standing shoulder to shoulder with Steve King, leading the fight to secure the borders. And what I did, that particular amendment, was an amendment I introduced to remove citizenship, to say those who are here illegally shall be permanently ineligible for citizenship. Now, the fact that I introduce an amendment to remove part of the Gang of Eight bill doesn't mean I support the rest of the Gang of Eight bill. The Gang of Eight bill was a mess. It was a terrible bill.
Well, wait a second,
and what
Senator,
the Rubio campaign is trying to claim is, well, gosh.
That is not what you said at the time. And Yahoo dug up these quotes from back then. You said, "If this amendment were to pass, the chances of this bill passing into law would increase dramatically." A few weeks later, during a debate on the Senate floor, Cruz repeated his belief that this amendment is the compromise that can pass. And you repeated later in Princeton that if my amendment were adopted, this bill would pass. It sounded like you wanted the bill to pass.
Of course I wanted the bill to pass, my amendment to pass. What my amendment did is take citizenship off the table, but it doesn't mean that I supported the other aspects of the bill, which was a terrible. And Brett, you've been around Washington long enough. You know how to defeat bad legislation, which is what that amendment did, is it revealed the hypocrisy of Chuck Schumer and the Senate Democrats and the establishment Republicans who were supporting them, because they all voted against it. And listen, I'll give you the simplest proof why this notion that my fighting amnesty somehow made me a supporter of amnesty. Jeff Sessions voted with me on my amendment to eliminate citizenship. Now, is anyone remotely suggesting that Jeff Sessions supports amnesty? Of course not.
Now,
we were fighting side by side to defeat Marco Rubio's amnesty, and we succeeded. We defeated it.
The problem, though, is that at the time, you were telling people like Byron York with the Washington Examiner that this was not a poison pill. You told him my objective was not to kill immigration reform. You said you wanted it to pass at the time. So my question to you is, looking back at what you said then and what you're saying now, which one should people believe?
What the amendments I introduced, and I introduced five amendments, a whole series of amendments, what they did is they illustrated the hypocrisy of the Democrats. They showed that it was a partisan effort, and they succeeded in defeating the Rubio-Schumer amnesty bill.
A massive appropriations bill expected to be approved by Congress would provide more than $1.6 billion to resettle illegal immigrants arriving at the U.S. border through 2018. Congress would award the massive check to the government just as the U.S. is experiencing a surge in arrivals of immigrant children at the southern border. Last week, federal agencies said they were opening two temporary shelters with 1,000 beds in South Texas to cope with the surge. A 400-bed shelter is also being opened in Southern California.
EU leaders, Marta, discussed today the creation of a controversial European Border and Coast Guard organization. It could see Brussels gain even more power than over member states. The draft security proposal to stem the flow of refugees suggests that this new border agency will have the right to intervene, crucially, in member states' affairs, even against their will, if there's a state of crisis. And that's got a lot of question marks raised. The idea has already got a broad welcome from Brussels, despite some nations' outcry about it.
I would just like to say how satisfied I am that the Commission's proposals were broadly welcomed by the heads of state and government.
It's astounding. There'd be an undemocratic structure.
I don't think that that would be appropriate.
I spoke to Ludo van Oost, a former deputy speaker of the Belgian Parliament just now, who believes that if the new border guard proposals are adopted, the EU could turn into a police state.
We are going to take measures that we know are totally unacceptable in democracies where there is rule of law. This is an abolition even further of sovereignty. What is happening is actually a very right-wing, an attempt to reform Europe in a very right-wing, a police state system. You use a crisis to instill, take positions, to take measures that would never be accepted if the normal democratic debate would have time to look into it. The so-called ideal of the European Union is gone. It's totally destroyed with this crisis. And this gives a very gloomy outlook on the future for Europe, yes, and the rest of the world.
This is real life Europe. And more importantly, Denmark. Denmark passes law to seize jewelry from refugees to cover expenses. That would mean gold, silver, jewelry, right? No. Denmark passed a law on Sunday to confiscate jewelry from refugees in order to make ends meet. Swedish national public TV broadcaster STV reported. Justice and Immigration Minister Soren Pind had last week defended the move during a live news program on the state-run TV channel, saying, quote, "This way, the revenue that is obtained can be used to meet the costs of the refugees." So hold on. You think, well, I mean, are these refugees bringing piles of gold and silver with them? No. Refugee, by the very definition of what classifies people as refugee, I'm fleeing a country, I've been third world status, and whatever happened, I'm leaving, is pretty much any refugee we've heard about the last, 100 years or so. And I thought, I wonder if I should play the song, "You Don't Have to Live Like a Refugee." I was like, I wonder if I should put that as a little intro music before I got started with the story. But I passed. I saved you one. I saved it for you. No need to hear my horrible voice on that one. So they may have a few little jewelry earrings. I mean, what are you going to get out of that? Denmark. Considering what it's going to cost, as we found out here, they said it's going to be, 160,000 or something like that in a 5-year span to cover the refugees coming to America, each of them. So divide that by 5 for the first year, right? Does that even come close to a few rings or a ring or two off of a refugee? And how many of them don't have? I mean, this is absurd. This is onion material. What am I reading here? However, he underlined that wedding or engagement rings, watches, and cell phones would not be confiscated, but all items with a value over 300 euros would be seized by the government. Hey, you poor people, you need a place to stay. Your poor country is being bombed by the Western power. Come over here. You know what this reminds me of? You ever see those commercials from Jack's Links Jerky? And they got the, messing with Sasquatch, and, Sasquatch has got some seeds, and he's just eating his seeds. And they're like, "Hey, buddy. Hey, refugee. You want to come over and get some seeds? Some food? Are you starving? Are you hungry? Thirsty? Come on. Yeah. Watch this. Come on. A little closer. A little past that line right there. Come across that line. Boom. Seize him. Get his rings. Get his wristwatch. Get it all. Boom. Mess him with Sasquatch. Messing with refugees. I had to do my own commercials. Wow. While the law is already drawing public criticism from Denmark and Sweden, police are trying to determine how it will be enforced. Denmark has been getting a bad reputation in Europe, especially since the Nordic country launched anti-refugee ads in September and shut off railway links to the country. Its anti-refugee stance has been in full spate since Denmark's ruling Liberal Party won power in June on an anti-immigration platform. So I guess they're saying in one way, well, we'll force these people not to come because they're going to hear that we're going to confiscate their goods, thing and like that. They may not want to come.
However, there's a whole bunch who ain't got nothing but the clothes that they're wearing on their backs and what's on their backs, a little backpack sometimes you'll see them with. That's all they got. They're not coming in there with tons of jewelry and, I mean, get out of here. What the hell's going on? Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. According to the Danish Immigration Service, or DIS, numbers indicate a skyrocketing refugee population in Denmark. Nearly double the number of refugees sought asylum in the country in 2014 than 2013, going from 7,557 to 14,815. Of the 14,000 plus refugees who sought asylum last year, less than half were granted official refugee status, totaling 6,110. The two largest groups who sought asylum in 2015 were from Syria and Eritrea. Never even heard of that country. And I wonder what those numbers are.
December 16th, 2015. We certainly cannot depend upon the mainstream media to inform us about things that truly affect all of us, such as the health risks associated with consuming genetically modified organisms or GMOs, or the solar radiation management campaign, the atmospheric aerosol spraying campaign that's been taking place for a long time, more commonly known as chemtrails, or the health risks of vaccines and the danger it poses to your children and the connection between autism, or even who created, funded, armed, and trained ISIS. All of those things you will find here on this channel. But what you can depend upon the mainstream media to tell you about 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is things like mass shootings. It seems like just about every one of these mass shootings takes place at a gun-free zone or near one, where law-abiding citizens are unconstitutionally prohibited under the threat of imprisonment to arm themselves and protect themselves. Now, here recently, we have seen school lockdowns in LA just yesterday, where they state a credible terror threat forced the Los Angeles Unified School District to close down more than 1,000 schools. It seems as if a car backfires near a school nowadays, they lock it down. And don't get me wrong, I am one for protecting the children, obviously, and erring on the side of caution. But we should have the rights to defend ourselves and defend those who cannot readily defend themselves, like children, for example. Openly advertising that schools are gun-free zones is like putting an open for business sign on the front door, inviting in terrorists or whoever. Now, I know that guns on campus is a very controversial subject for a lot of people, but a North Texas school was considering arming their teachers. Now, they would have to get physically cleared, also get psychologically cleared, and then the law would require the school board to individually approve each teacher. And this is in the North Texas area. They had a board meeting today at 6 p.m., and the board approved the policy allowing selected staff in schools to carry guns. Now, I personally think that this is a good idea. Now, no doubt that staff member is taking on a huge, huge responsibility, and they need to really be aware of that. Even if there is a situation that goes down to where that staff member would have to use that firearm, they need to know, they need to be 100% aware and clear of the fact that whatever you're shooting at, there's potentially targets behind that or through walls. I mean, the last thing we want is anyone, especially children, to get hurt, obviously. But hopefully this will act as a deterrent rather than advertising openly that your school is a gun-free zone. So the Keene School District in Texas is the first one in Texas to arm their teachers. Now, this information, this story just broke about an hour ago. So this is breaking information. It's so new, I couldn't even find an article on it yet. I had to refer back to this tweet of the local Fox affiliate there in Dallas-Fort Worth. So leave it to Texas, huh, guys? I'll leave links. Until next time, this is Spiro, and stay armed, America. Much love.
Hey, let me ask you a question.
Ask away, my friend. Ask away.
Asks you a question. This Bo Bergdahl thing.
Bo Bergdahl thing.
Now, I kind of was like not following it. I was like, whatever. I really don't care, you know. And I kind of remember where we didn't know if he was a deserter or if, you know, if he was really captured or what's going on. And, you know, so now apparently there is a court martial in process.
Right.
And it's so high up, of course. Well, actually, I'll play. This is Josh Earnest. This is the spokesperson for the White House. He speaks directly for the president, as he will refer to in this clip. And he can't say anything on behalf of anybody for anything he doesn't know that he does know not to do.
John, unfortunately, in this instance, I'm very, very limited in what I can say about this ongoing matter. This is a case that is currently working its way through the military justice process. And as the spokesperson for the commander in chief, there's a lot of sensitivity about the potential for influencing the outcome of that military justice proceeding. So I'm really not able to react even in the most general terms to the latest twists and turns in the case. There's an established process whereby the military will both conduct this investigation and consider the results of it. And I don't want to say anything that could be perceived as influencing that process in any way. But the bottom line for this matter is that Sergeant Bergdahl was an American citizen who put on the uniform of the United States military, and he was rescued by the United States military. And the commander-in-chief feels a responsibility to everyone who puts on the uniform that we're not going to leave them behind. And the way that this, the way that Sergeant Bergdahl was rescued, I think, is a testament to the president's commitment to that principle.
Okay. now, you know, so I'm listening to that. I'm like, wow. I of course, do remember the big, you know, no man left behind. We'll do anything we want to do. And the more I'm hearing this change of story, the more I'm thinking maybe something else was going on, that we had a number of theories, I believe.
No, we had guys that were in his company or at least connected to him somehow send us notes before the thing, the story even broke, that this guy was a deserter.
Well, I think we're talking about something even a little bit bigger than that. And
you think he was on a mission?
Yes. And I will explain why with a few clips.
You better be very convincing, because I never got that impression.
Okay.
I just think he was a dingbat.
Well, okay. Here's what bothered me, and the reason I looked into this whole Bergdahl crew little booty. Okay. The whole reason I looked into him is because the second season of, without any doubt, the number one most downloaded best in the whole universe podcast, Serial, has started its new season. And in its new season, it is doing the Bo Bergdahl story.
Right.
And the coincidence of they just released episode number 2 today. I have not heard it. Now, I don't listen to Serial, but I am now. And I listened to the opening episode, the first one. And the coincidence of this court martial taking place with the release of the Serial podcast got me interested. And here's what I picked out.
Now, I will say this, which is a performative.
yeah.
I knew this too. I knew that Serial decided to do the Berg. Serial is a long exposition. It's like a long news story,
yeah,
the way I see it. And they're going to do Bo Bergdahl for some reason. I did not pick up on any of this, any nefarious thing. I just ignored it completely. But I'm glad you.
And I will tell you, I was ready to ignore it. I was doing a good job ignoring it. But my no agenda Spidey sense tickled me and said, look into it, Adam. Look into it. So I did what apparently hundreds of millions of people around the universe do. I listened to the Serial podcast. And here's the first bit I thought was relevant to my suspicion.
Mark Boal is a screenwriter and producer. You've probably heard of his movies, The Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty. Mark wanted to make a movie about Bo's story. So a couple of months after Bo came back to the U.S., Mark managed to contact him, and they started talking about everything, about the Taliban and motorcycles and the existence of God and how good spicy salsa is and how memory works and what a soldier should and shouldn't be. Mark recorded the calls, not for broadcast or anything, which is why you sometimes hear Mark making himself a snack.
Yeah, there are.
There was one bike I saw.
Or the swoosh of Mark sending an email, or his dog scuffling around.
Hold on one sec. Can you...
Now, before I continue with this, so this was a bit of a disappointment because the way it was positioned, everything I'd read about it, I was like, oh, they have Bergdahl. They've interviewed him and they're going to do this whole long, you know, I don't know how many episodes they do of the Serial podcast, but they'll have Bergdahl in his own words. And I found that to be fascinating. Turns out they do not have Bergdahl. They have this recording that the known collaborator with the CIA, this director, these two movies, come on, we have dissected and deconstructed who is running these movies. These movies are meant to create an official story of what happened. This is the official story of, you know, the Hurt Locker. It's the official way it had many, many servicemen and women have contacted us saying total bullcrap. And then, of course, Zero Dark 30, the official story of how we got Osama bin Laden. And I'm like, okay, that's a disappointment, but it got better.
Hold on one second.
It's roughly 25 hours of recorded conversations, a lot of it rangy and raw. Their rapport is sort of unexpected. Mark swears a lot. He can be blunt. While Bo, the soldier, comes off as the softer one. His go-to expletive is good grief. For this story, we've teamed up with Mark and his production company, Page One. They'd come to us saying, hey, we've been doing all this reporting on the story, and we've also got this tape. Do you think you might want to listen?
Okay, so here we are. We're looking for season two. And this guy comes along, famous for his work. Hey, you know, we got a story, you know, maybe we got this tape, you know, maybe it would be kind of cool if, you know, we could team up and work together, you know. You guys are independent, you know, your podcast, you're hip. Maybe we could get a real narrative out there. I mean, yeah, wouldn't it be cool to do like a whole series?
And yes, we did. And we were kind of blown away.
Blown away.
And so we began working with them.
They shared their
research with us.
Oh, their research. Okay, here's our research. Take it as true.
And also put us in touch with many of their sources.
Oh, I bet they were doozies.
Especially soldiers. We don't have anything to do with their movie.
No, of course not.
But Mark and Page One are our partners for season two.
They're our partners for season two. So this
okay,
is...
Okay, hold on a second. Stop. Now you've got my... You've done it. You've come up with...
This is the feeling I had.
This is why we work as a team. Because one of us will do something like this.
That's right. From time to time.
But it brings to mind, since I never paid much attention to Serial, two questions come to mind. One... Season one, was that some sort of a plant? I don't know what the story was. I never listened to the Serial. I didn't think much of the idea.
There was a story about a guy that was boring.
Okay, so there was nothing in season one that would indicate there was intelligence agencies.
I cannot answer that because I just didn't listen too much of it at all. I'm now beginning the following
automatic deconstruction based on our basic way of thinking. Is it possible that Serial is designed as a throughput mechanism for intelligence agencies in this case?
So my answer would be yes.
And is that why it gets so much publicity and all the rest? Because the whole thing is planted.
I think it feeds upon itself. So there's another movie being made. We need to have an official story of what happened. And when you listen to Bergdahl, the story that in this season one, the story he is retelling is that he had a plan, and his plan was actually to create a they call it a dust woo. Is it dust? Dust one, which is, you know, a guy's gone and whereabouts unknown. And his thinking, the way he's telling it on this tape that I've heard in this first episode, is he wanted to create a way to show Washington and the really, really higher ups that there was incredibly bad management going on in his platoon at the base. And he felt that he had no other recourse. He wanted to be a whistleblower, but the way he wanted to do it is he wanted to, you know, create this big, big hype about him being gone. Then they would find him. And then he would say, oh, you know, thank God I have the stage. Here's what's going on. But it went wrong because he messed up the way he escaped. And he wound up during the daylight in the middle of the desert, surrounded by Taliban. And then he was captured for 5 years. So that is the story he wants to tell.
Yes, went astray.
That's the story he wants to tell. Now, based on this next little clip from two guys who were with him and who discovered him gone, They were always noticing that he was hanging out way too much with the local police force, talking to him way too much. And then this little ditty, which is completely overlooked by the Serial podcast.
You know, he'd been showing up late to guard shifts because he was busy talking to the locals.
That's Josh Corder. Here's Daryl Hansen. His guesses were expansive.
We're like, man, is he like CIA or what? I mean, is he like this crazy like mole?
Right. So like, what was the discussion? Yeah. Like, what were you guys thinking?
Did you hear that really bad edit? They put those two things after another like fools. Hold on a second.
Like mole.
Right. So like, what was the discussion? Yeah. Like, what were you guys thinking?
That's what we did. Yeah. That's what we were thinking.
Yeah. Giveaway. Like, very poorly done.
I mean, those are.
Hold on. Yeah, let's just go back. I want you to hear what they say there again. Hold on.
Yeah, so we were just thinking, like, I mean, those are the things. Like, it was either, like, this guy's a complete lunatic, or is he, like, CIA? Like, we were trying to, like, we couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, because those are pretty much your options. And I know how guys are sitting like, this guy's a spook. What's he doing in our platoon? So I can only conclude that this was an extraction, and it went wrong. And now they're trying to build up some story for some reason. Because people died during the, you know, during the extraction, people died searching for him. And that is, you know, that's bad optics. I believe it was a CIA extraction and was never supposed to have this big media coverage. And the president was never supposed to say, we'll get every last guy. And he took that to be his, you know, for to show him as a strong leader. And we support our troops. But then he messed up the whole quiet nature of it being a CIA extraction. And when you think about Bergdahl being there for 5 years, yeah, it's very possible he had some good intel.
All right. Well, I mean, that's an interesting thesis. I mean,
it's a screwy situation because first you got this dad who learned out of the blue, decided to learn Arabic and grow a Taliban beard yeah. and then meet with the president on his porch.
Yeah.
How does that come about? That's never happened with anybody else.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe the old man is a spook.
Yeah, could be.
And
he could be.
You know, and he was in Langley at the time, so he decided to stop by. Although I find this incredible, personally. I mean, it's a nice story. I think as a spook story, I think it's a cool story. I really just find it ridiculous, though. This guy seems like a dope. And the old man seems like a lunatic of some sort.
You know, I wouldn't have had that much of an issue with it if it wasn't that Serial was approached by these guys, by the film company.
I see the same red flag.
And you know, Serial, it's like, I can just see the guys, we really need to get this going. We need this to go viral. I know.
Don't forget.
Remember.
All the media that's all in the all the podcast stories. Oh, Serial, which you brought up right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. It was, why hasn't Serial done anything? They haven't done a season two. They're no good. They're one trick pony. And there was a lot of complaining about mm-hmm. this. And mm-hmm. so this is the opportunity, as you point out, for somebody to come along and give them a story already prepared.
Yeah,
because that's the way it's done.
Yeah.
Just look at a Bob Woodward book. Yeah. And here you go.
Yeah.
You can put your name on it. Just take it.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Because they were under the gun, the Serial people.
Yes.
Guy who just wandered off and got, disappeared for 5 years. And maybe we don't even know he really disappeared for 5 years, do we?
We obviously don't know the whole story. We don't.
We don't even know. They had pictures of him and he's got, you know, guys with the hoods. That could have been made anywhere.
He could have been
working in an office in Washington, D.C. And then 5 years later, put him in a truck. We don't know who those people were that dropped him off. We don't know anything.
No, we don't.
The whole thing could be bull crap.
Yes. Anyway, our job is to deconstruct media. This is media. There's your deconstruction.
Well,
we'll see what happens. But when guys sit around and they're suspicious of their fellow servicemen and women, and they think you're a spook, there's something wrong with you. You're probably a spook. You're probably a spook. Very tight quarters. You got to be. You know, you're really on top of each other. You get to know each other. And this guy, he was always weird. He felt like a spook. It couldn't be anything else. You heard it right there. And they just gloss over that by saying, well, they had some outrageous thoughts.
A part of that plan, of course, is to induce the gradual surrender of American sovereignty, piece by piece and step by step, to various international organizations
of which the United Nations is the outstanding but far from the only example. Now, here are the aims for the United States. One, greatly expanded government spending for every conceivable means of getting rid of ever larger sums of American money as wastefully as possible. Two, higher and then much higher taxes. Three, an increasingly unbalanced budget despite the higher taxes. Four, wild inflation of our currency. Five, government controls of prices, wages, and materials, supposedly to combat inflation. Six, greatly increased socialistic controls over every operation of our economy and every activity of our daily lives. This is to be accompanied, naturally and automatically, by a correspondingly huge increase in the size of our bureaucracy and in both the cost and reach of our domestic government. Seven, far more centralization of power in Washington and the practical elimination of our state lines. There is a many-faceted drive at work to have our state lines eventually mean no more within the nation than our county lines do now within the states. Eight, the steady advance of federal aid to and control over our educational system, leading to complete federalization of our public education. Nine, a constant hammering into the American consciousness of the horror of modern warfare, the beauties and the absolute necessity of peace. Peace always on communist terms, of course. And 10, the consequent willingness of the American people to allow the steps of appeasement by our government, which amount to a piecemeal surrender of the rest of the free world and of the United States itself. So brush the insider's dust out of your eyes, my friends, and the communist soap suds out of your brain, and ask yourselves in all honesty, what on earth is wrong with the United States simply minding its own business? With having its foreign policy function primarily for the safety and benefit of the American people. Which is exactly what we had done for the first 140 years of our existence as a nation, to the incredible advantage of ourselves and everybody else. Everybody, that is, except a numerically small clique of power-lusting conspirators who had somehow inflicted themselves on a gullible world. While we turn to a very brief summarization of what we hope the John Birch Society will help and even sometimes lead the American people to accomplish during the next 15 years. One, our first and most important specific undertaking should be to restore the complete independence of the United States. This includes our resolution to get us out of the United Nations and get the United Nations out of the United States. Two, we must once again make our money freely redeemable in gold at some realistic price. And we must take all practicable legislative steps to prevent a recurrence of the enormous thievery and other subversive crimes that have been perpetrated on the American people through a contrived inflation by every president from Franklin Roosevelt through Richard Nixon. Three, we should reduce the number of government bureaus, of government civilian employees, and the whole quantity of government by at least 50%. And we should achieve at least this much reduction in proper fashion through gradually convincing a majority of the American people of the wisdom of such a course. 4, we should withdraw all American troops from every spot on earth that is not American soil, except when and where such troops may be required as decided by Congress to protect American lives and property from criminal vandalism. 5. We should get government out of the areas and functions and activities where government does not belong. Again, all steps to this end should be taken gradually, but nevertheless just as rapidly as enough of the American people can be persuaded to support such progress. Any such achievement will require a truly massive educational force, but that's exactly what we hope to build during the next 15 years. We could go ahead for at least 100 numbered items, but the John Birch Society will undoubtedly be working on more than that many specific projects, which will be laid out in its bulletins before another 180 months will have rolled around. And all of them will fit into, all of these projects will fit into the general pattern indicated by the 5 major objectives listed above. So let's really wind up this marathon monologue with one final thought. None of us can guarantee anything about what the future will bring. Your speaker knows what a job we have before us to rid our country of the scourge of communism within the next few years, and then to go ahead on our constructive program so well that 15 years from now, we shall already be entering an era of far less government, of a much sounder sense of responsibility, and, with God's help, of a better world. But I sincerely believe that it can be done, and this much I know. If every man and woman in this audience should leave here tonight feeling in his or her own mind and heart that it can and must be done, then it surely will be. And so, all of you patriots of good character, good conscience, and noble ideals, whom we can reach with the filmed version of this speech in 1,000 other audiences, it is with a great deal of confidence and energizing will to win that we invite you to join us in our epic undertaking. While to all of you great, wonderful friends in this present audience, I certainly extend my very deep thanks indeed for so much patience and attention. Thank you and good night.